Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the March 20th, 2026 issue of the Week. Our cover drawing this week, we have Secretary of War or Secretary of Defense Pete Hegseth. Looks like he's standing on the stage at the Pentagon. In the background, you see one of his generals looking on. He himself is in army green pants with no shirt. You can see tattoos all over his arms and chest. He's holding an automatic rifle with a long sleeve of extra bullets draped across his shoulder. He's got a red bandana tied around his head and war paint and seems to be screaming at the audience. The headline is Hegseth's Rules. Does pulverizing Iran achieve U.S. goals? And that shows up several places. There's two connected main stories. Trump offers shifting goals for the war, and the second one is as Iran batters region throttling oil market. I think we'll start with the second main story today. Iran batters region throttling oil market. What happened? The International Energy Agency this week announced the largest release of its oil reserves in history in an attempt to rein in skyrocketing oil prices after Iran choked off access to the Strait of Hormuz and bombarded oil facilities in Arab states. The IEA, whose members include the U.S. and much of the West, approved a release of 400 million barrels of oil, and President Trump said he would tap the U.S. Strategic Reserve. The announcements came after Iran mined the Strait, a conduit for 20% of the world's oil, and launched hundreds of missiles and drones against oil drilling and refining sites in Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Iraq, causing casualties, fires, and infrastructure damage. Iran also hurled drones at commercial ships in the region, hitting three and setting one aflame. As a bottleneck of hundreds of tankers built up, Trump suggested the Navy could escort ships through the strait, although the Pentagon said it had no orders to do so. Former House Speaker Newt Gingrich said reopening the passage was critical. If they can't keep it open, he said, this war will in fact be an American defeat before very long because the entire world will react to the price of oil. After Trump said that more expensive energy was a small price to pay for defeating Iran, oil briefly hit $120 a barrel, then dropped somewhat. Gasoline prices shot up 20% to an average over $3.50 a gallon, and diesel prices rose by over 25%. Running out of storage and unable to intercept all of Iran's strikes, Iraq, Kuwait, and other Gulf nations slashed their oil production. We are in a potentially game-changing and unprecedented energy crisis, said former IEA official Neil Atkinson. What the columnist said. The oil crisis has become impossible to either ignore or deny, said Jonathan B. Last in The Bulwark. The cost of fuel, gasoline, and domestic shipping are rising even as the economy slows. That combination could cause stagflation, last seen in the 1970s. And while every previous oil shock in American history was the result of external events, such as foreign wars, disasters, or terrorist attacks, this one was caused by the wishes of the U.S. president. Trump should have known that Iran would close the strait, said Franklin Foer in The Atlantic. Almost no other foreign policy question has been studied harder over the past 20 years or so than the likely effect of U.S. military strikes on Iran. No other president chose a full-scale attack because analysts were convinced that to do so would cause skyrocketing oil prices and rampant violence across the Middle East. The president ignored the obvious because he thought he was invincible. And now the obvious is taking its revenge. The U.S. is more exposed to oil price shocks than any other major power, including China, said Rosemary Kalanick in the New York Times. We have a high oil intensity, meaning it takes the U.S. much more oil than most countries to produce each dollar of GDP. Releasing oil from the reserves can help only temporarily. No wonder the GOP is panicking, said Meredith Lee Hill in Politico. Analysts say the impact of the crisis could erase the tax benefits from the big, beautiful bill for at least the bottom 30% of Americans. Voters who are suffering may punish the Republicans in the midterms. The high prices are good for at least one country, Russia, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. Oil sales make up a huge chunk of Russia's revenue, and money is pouring in. Compounding that windfall, the U.S. actually granted a sanctions waiver to India, which is running short of oil and gas thanks to the Straits closure, so it can buy Russian oil. China's doing pretty well, too. It's sitting on a stockpile of up to 1.4 billion barrels of crude while still managing to get oil shipped from Iran. And it's watching the U.S. use up weapons on Iran, weapons that won't be available to protect Taiwan should Beijing attack. How this war ends may be less a question of drones, ships, and artillery than supply chains, inflation, and debt markets, said Rana Faruhar in the Financial Times. Iranian leaders are betting that the rise in oil prices will threaten such an economic cataclysm that Trump has to call off the war. If the long-term impact of this war is to trigger a big sell-off in U.S. treasuries, the U.S. and global economy will suffer mightily. Our controversy of the week, hearkening back to the cover drawing, Hegseth waging a macho war in Iran. Does Pete Hegseth think he's in an action movie, asked Casey Ryan Kelly in Salon. In his Pentagon News briefings on the war with Iran, the defense secretary has projected none of the solemnity you'd expect from a government official discussing the taking of human life. Instead, Hegseth seems giddy about the horrors of war, rhapsodizing about U.S. bombers and drones raining death and destruction from the sky all day long. He's dismissed concerns about the rules of engagement, explaining it is not a fair fight. We are punching them while they're down. And he shrugged at news reports on America's war dead, saying, tragic things happen. The press only wants to make the president look bad. This is what President Trump thinks a real warrior looks and sounds like, said David Smith in The Guardian. A Christian nationalist with tattoos of the Crusades-era Jerusalem cross and slogan, Dos Volt, God Wills It, Hegseth won Trump's attention as a Fox News host advocating for U.S. troops accused of war crimes. He's the perfect figurehead for a White House that revels in carnage, and which last week posted a video online that mixed clips from video games and war movies with real kill shot footage of strikes on Iran. This bloodlust may play well in the manosphere, but it doesn't inspire confidence in the judgment of those leading this murky new Middle East conflict. The bellicose messaging of this administration is accompanied by open hostility to battlefield restraint, said Missy Ryan in The Atlantic. We still don't know why a U.S. Tomahawk cruise missile struck an Iranian elementary school on the war's first day, killing at least 175 people, most of them children. But we do know Trump and Hegseth have spent the past year dismantling the supposedly woke systems designed to prevent such tragedies, firing many military lawyers, or JAGs, and closing a policy shop focused on reducing civilian casualties. Hegseth says he won't comment on the school strike, pending an internal investigation, but he was less reticent in savoring the quiet death of 87 Iranian sailors killed when a U.S. submarine torpedoed a possibly unarmed Iranian frigate off Sri Lanka. Distastefulness aside, said Charlotte Howard in The Economist, the deeper problem with Hegseth's machismo style is that it's now also the substance of U.S. military policy. Machismo is part of the story, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic, but the fetishization of violence for its own sake is also helping fill a strategic vacuum. Previous U.S. presidents went to war with a clear goal in mind, however unrealistic, whereas Trump is still deciding if the Iran operation is an air campaign to degrade Iran's nuclear and missile programs, a full-scale regime change war, or something else entirely. The lack of a goal and a plan for achieving it leaves the White House with nothing to celebrate except the rapid destruction of buildings and machines and the killing of some enemy leaders, all while praying that the public is enjoying the fireworks as much as Hegseth. The tragedy is that Trump had very good reasons for going to war with Iran, said Gerard Baker in the Wall Street Journal. The vicious Islamist regime in Tehran has waged war on the U.S. and the Iranian people for almost half a century. Given an opportunity to inflict massive damage on the enemy, the president boldly seized it. But rather than make that persuasive case to the public, Trump and Hegseth have leaned on intemperate, incontinent, infantilizing verbiage that only weakens support for this just cause at home and overseas and corrupts our national culture. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for Florsheim. After the Wall Street Journal reported that President Trump has fallen in love with the brand of affordable leather dress shoes and now routinely gifts pairs to agency heads, lawmakers, and VIPs. Everybody's afraid not to wear them, said a White House official. It was a good week for going off after Miami Heat center Bam Adebayo scored a whopping 83 points in a game against the Washington Wizards, the second highest total in NBA history. In the course of his offensive explosion, Adebayo also set records for free throws attempted, 43, and made, 36. It's a good week for Bernese Bros. After officials in the Swiss canton of Bern ruled that the bear on its official coat of arms will continue to be depicted with a conspicuous red penis, as it has been for at least the past 600 years, rejecting a liberal green lawmaker's proposal that with a de-sexed bear, the population as a whole would feel better represented. But it was a bad week for steerage. After reports that Southwest Airlines has a new policy of cleaning only its premium seats between flights, while economy cabins are merely tidied. In a statement, Southwest stopped short of an outright denial, but noted that extended legroom seats are toward the front of the plane, so they see more foot traffic than the seats in the back. It was a bad week for our robot overlords. After an NBC poll found only 26% of Americans have positive feelings about artificial intelligence, while 46% hold a negative view. The only entities with higher net negatives were the Democratic Party, 22%, and Iran, negative 53%, with whom the U.S. is at war. Finally, it was a bad week for portraiture. After the Washington Post reported that the Pentagon had barred all press photographers from briefings on the Iran war because several outlets published photos of Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth speaking at a March 2nd briefing that his staff deemed unflattering. And a short in other news piece, FDA's vaccine chief Tlaib. The Food and Drug Administration announced last week that its top regulator, Dr. Vinay Prasad, will depart the agency at the end of April, ending a chaotic 10-month tenure. As the FDA's chief science and medical officer, Prasad had oversight of vaccines, drugs, and gene therapies, and was repeatedly criticized by lawmakers and pharmaceutical companies for delaying or restricting regulatory approvals. In one of his most controversial decisions, he refused to consider Moderna's application for a new mRNA flu shot, a decision quickly reversed after a flurry of calls with the White House officials. Late last year, he was accused of moving the regulatory goalpost for a gene therapy for Huntington's disease, which afflicts about 40,000 people in the U.S., and for which there is no cure. FDA boss Martin Makary said Prasad had always intended to return to his academic job at the University of California, San Francisco, after a one-year sabbatical. The briefing this week is titled, Gambling on Everything. Americans are betting billions on prediction markets like Kalshi and Polymarket. What could go wrong? What are prediction markets? They're online platforms where users can bet on the outcomes of future events. Almost any event can be added to the market, who will win the Super Bowl or an election, the direction of a California wildfire will spread, whether the U.S. will confirm the existence of aliens before 2027, when the Cuban president will be ousted. Proponents say these markets are different from traditional gambling because they double as valuable sources of information that can help governments, businesses, and ordinary citizens make smart decisions. Prediction markets are the most effective way to aggregate information and the crowd wisdom, said Tariq Mansour, who co-founded Kalshi in 2018. Critics counter that platforms like Kalshi and Polymarket are just another way to bilk gambling-addicted Americans, and that they are rife with insider trading. The day before the U.S. went to war with Iran, more than 150 accounts placed a total of $855,000 in bets, correctly predicting an American strike over the next 24 hours. At least 16 accounts made over $100,000. It makes you think it was someone who knew something about the timing, said economist Eric Zeitweitz. Such incidents are unlikely to slow the market's rapid growth. About $12 billion was traded on Kalshi and Polymarket in December, up more than 400% from a year earlier. How do the markets work? Users place bets by buying a contract, a yes or no option on a question such as, will the Democrats win the House in the midterms? The value of the contract moves up and down like a stock, fluctuating between $0 and $1. That price reflects the market's view on the likelihood of a future event. 30 cents means there's a 30% likelihood, for example. A payout occurs if the event happens and the value of the contract hits $1. Unlike a traditional sports book, there is no house that makes money when bettors lose. Instead, the platform makes money by charging transaction fees on contracts. Prediction markets say the lack of a house means they shouldn't be regulated like casinos, and that their platforms are legitimate financial instruments because they let users hedge against risk. Many experts are skeptical of those claims. It definitely looks, smells, and feels like gambling, said Steve Ruddock, a gambling industry analyst. How are they regulated? Lightly. Prediction markets are overseen by the Federal Commodity Futures Trading Commission, and the Trump administration has taken a soft touch with the industry. President Trump's son, Donald Trump Jr., has invested in Polymarket through his venture capital firm and is an advisor to Cauchy. Several states have sued or sent cease and desist letters to prediction markets over sports gambling, which is banned in 20 states, and where it is allowed, is typically legal only for over 21s. States say the markets are skirting those rules, as well as the tax obligations of sports books, a major source of revenue for a state like Nevada. CFTC head Mike Selig has vowed to defend prediction markets against what he calls an onslaught of state litigation. Utah Governor Spencer Cox, a Republican, promised in turn that he would take prediction markets and the CFTC to court, saying the markets are destroying the lives of families and countless Americans, especially young men. Is that true? Some users have made huge profits on the market. Logan Sudeith, 25, quit his job as a financial risk analyst to become a full-time gambler on Cauchy and Polymarket. He told NPR he made $100,000 in 1 month, $25,000 more than he used to make in a year. A bet on Time, magazine's Person of the Year alone, earned him $40,236. Alan Cole, a 37-year-old tax economist, put $342,195.63, his life savings, into Cauchy bets that Elon Musk's Doge wouldn't successfully cut government spending. He netted over $128,000. But for every big winner, there are many more losers. K.A., a 24-year-old engineer from Virginia, told Business Insider that he pumped $10,000 into Cauchy over 8 days in December and took out loans so he could place more bets. "There'll be a big winning streak at the beginning," he said. "Then bam, everything's gone." Critics say the prevalence of insider trading on the platforms means the odds are rigged against ordinary Americans. How common is insider trading? Anecdotal evidence suggests it's prevalent. In February, an anonymous day-old Polymarket account won $17,000 by correctly guessing 17 of 20 bets about the Super Bowl halftime show, including whether Lady Gaga and Ricky Martin would appear, a success rate that strongly suggests the better had inside information. Other examples are more concerning. Less than 5 hours before the January raid that captured Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, a Polymarket account doubled down on bets that the U.S. would invade Venezuela. The trader netted more than $400,000, but Polymarket didn't pay out, saying the raid didn't count as an invasion. In Israel, a civilian and military reservist were arrested last month for allegedly using secret intelligence to place Polymarket wagers on military operations. "Such bets are dangerous," said Joseph Grundfest, a former Securities and Exchange Commissioner, "because you are signaling to your enemies what may happen." Are there any guardrails? Some. Cauchy said it has enacted new rules based on those of the New York Stock Exchange and NASDAQ. If you have material, non-public information on a market, you cannot trade it, said Mansour. But regulation remains largely voluntary. The CFTC has no guidelines on insider trading on the platforms, and Polymarket has no explicit ban on the practice. Some prediction market evangelists want to keep the rules lax. Insider trading, said Trey Upshaw, who runs a startup that provides analytics for Polymarket traders, just accelerates the truth faster. And a few of the best columns. First two come from the U.S. the military's evangelical holy war. President Donald Trump can't get his story straight on why he launched a war against Iran, said Zishan Alim. But commanders in the field have told U.S. soldiers it's a biblically sanctioned holy war that will trigger the end times. The Military Religious Freedom Foundation told journalist Jonathan Larson it has received more than 110 complaints from 40 military units that commanders are portraying the conflicts in overtly Christian evangelical terms. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth has openly endorsed evangelical Christianity as the military's guiding philosophy, and has even instituted Christian worship services at the Pentagon. Freed by Hegseth to mix church and state, his chosen commanders are telling troops that Trump was anointed by Jesus to start a Middle East war to save Israel, trigger Armageddon, and bring the second coming of Christ, as predicted in the book of Revelation. Complaints filed to MRFF say the religious messages violate the Constitution and destroy morale and unit cohesion. This proselytizing is also deeply dangerous. Telling American troops that they're fighting for a Christian God against a Muslim country is medieval madness. It signals to the military it can engage in God-sanctioned combat and human rights violations. Prosecuting the parents of shooters. A jury last week convicted a Georgia father of second-degree murder, even though he did not kill anyone, said Austin Surratt. The verdict was a clear message to parents that they cannot stand idly by in the build-up to a school shooting. Colin Gray, now 55, bought his 14-year-old son, Colt, an AR-15 and ignored clear signs of the teenager's mental deterioration, even when he put a poster of the Parkland shooter on his bedroom wall. In September 2024, the teen used the weapon his dad gave him to kill two classmates and two teachers and wound nine others. Hundreds of school shootings take place each year, and not every parent is culpable. But in some recent cases, the parental negligence was egregious. The parents of Michigan school shooter Ethan Crumbly, the first to be convicted of murder for a child school shooting, sent their 15-year-old son to school the same day he drew a gun, a bleeding person, and a plea for help. Colt's drug-addicted parents ignored his growing signs of paranoia and the step-by-step plans for a shooting he wrote in a notebook. Parents who give guns to troubled kids should not walk away unscathed if they misuse them. This column comes from Russia. How to raise your children in wartime. Today's parents have bigger concerns than teaching kids to ride a bike or solve fractions, said Olga Klimakina. With military conflict now a constant in our lives, the challenge is how to explain war to children without breaking their psyche. When I was little, I attended Victory Day parades marking the defeat of the Nazis, and adults confidently told me, "Don't worry, there won't be another war." Now, 4 years after the fighting started in Ukraine, we can't make that promise. Just last week, my 7-year-old son heard on the playground that the U.S. was bombing Iran. "Mom, are we going to evacuate?" he asked as he painted a wooden model tank. "They could easily bomb us, too." His classmates are spreading rumors that saboteurs have hidden bombs in toys, that spies could kidnap him right out of reading class. As parents, we have to address these fears calmly, directly, honestly. We can't brush them off. Tell your children that they are not in any danger right now and that you will do everything possible to keep them safe. Focus on small acts of kindness. Feed the birds, visit a dog shelter, bake a pie for a lonely neighbor. Concrete, positive action builds confidence and security. We can't stop the waves of history, but we can teach children to swim. And it's time for the last word, our in-depth article. Killing Khamenei. Before Israel assassinated Iran's supreme leader, said the Financial Times, it spent years watching the Ayatollah and his bodyguards through hacked traffic cameras in Tehran. When the highly trained, loyal bodyguards and drivers of senior Iranian officials came to work near Pasteur Street in Tehran, where Ayatollah Ali Khamenei was killed in an Israeli airstrike on Saturday, February 28th, the Israelis were watching. Nearly all the traffic cameras in Tehran had been hacked for years, their images encrypted and transmitted to servers in Tel Aviv and southern Israel, according to two people familiar with the matter. One camera had an angle that proved particularly useful, said one of the people, allowing them to determine where the men liked to park their personal cars and providing a window into the workings of a mundane part of the closely guarded compound. Complex algorithms added details to dossiers on members of these security guards that included their addresses, hours of duty, routes they took to work, and, most importantly, who they were usually assigned to protect and transport, building what intelligence officers call a pattern of life. The capabilities were part of a years-long intelligence campaign that helped pave the way for the Ayatollah's assassination. This source of real-time data, one of hundreds of different streams of intelligence, was not the only way Israel and the Central Intelligence Agency were able to determine exactly what time 86-year-old Khamenei would be in his offices this fateful Saturday morning and who would be joining him. Nor was the fact that Israel was also able to disrupt single components of roughly a dozen or so mobile phone towers near Pasteur Street, making the phones seem as if they were busy when called and stopping Khamenei's protection detail from receiving possible warnings. Long before the bombs fell, we knew Tehran like we know Jerusalem, said one current Israeli intelligence official. And when you know a place as well as you know the street you grew up on, you notice a little thing that's out of place. The dense intelligence picture of the archenemy's capital was a result of laborious data collection made possible by Israel's sophisticated signals intelligence unit 8200. The human assets recruited by its foreign intelligence agency, Mossad, and the mountains of data digested by military intelligence into daily briefs. Israel used a mathematical method known as social network analysis to parse billions of data points to unearth unlikely centers of decision-making gravity and identify fresh targets to surveil and kill, said a person familiar with the use. All this fed an assembly line with a single product, targets. And in Israeli intelligence culture, targeting intelligence is the most essential tactical issue. It is designed to enable a strategy, said Itai Shapira, a brigadier general in the Israeli military reserves and 25-year veteran of its intelligence directorate. If the decision-maker decides that someone has to be assassinated, in Israel the culture is, we will provide the targeting intelligence. Israel has assassinated hundreds of people overseas, including militant leaders, nuclear scientists, chemical engineers, and killed many innocent bystanders in the process. But even with the killing of as prominent a political and religious leader as Khamenei, how much this aggressive, decades-long use of its technological and technical prowess has paved the way for major strategic gains is fiercely debated both within and outside Israel. The country's intelligence superiority was on full display in the 12-day war last June, when more than a dozen Iranian nuclear scientists and high-ranking military officials were assassinated within minutes an opening salvo. That had been accompanied by an unprecedented disabling of Iran's aerial defenses through a combination of cyber attacks, low-range drones, and precise munitions fired from outside Iran's border, destroying the radars of the Russian-built missile launchers. "We took their eyes first," said one intelligence official. "Both in the June war and now, Israeli pilots have used a specific kind of missile called the Sparrow, variants of which are able to hit a target as small as a dining table from more than 600 miles away, far from Iran and the reach of any of its aerial defense systems." Not all the details of the latest operation are known. Some may never be made public in order to protect sources and methods still being used to track down other targets. But killing Khamenei was a political decision, not simply a technological achievement, said more than half a dozen current and former Israeli intelligence officials interviewed for this story. When the CIA and Israel determined that Khamenei would be holding a meeting on Saturday morning at his offices near Pasteur Street, the chance to kill him alongside so much of Iran's senior leadership was especially opportune. They assessed that hunting them down after a war had properly begun would have been much harder, since the Iranians would quickly embark on evasive practices, including heading underground to bunkers immune to Israeli bombs. Khamenei, unlike his ally, Hezbollah leader Hassan Nasrallah, did not live in hiding. Nasrallah had spent years of his life in underground bunkers, dodging several Israeli assassination attempts until September 2024, when Israeli fighter jets dropped as many as 80 bombs over his hideout in Beirut. Instead, Khamenei had mused in public about the possibility of being killed, dismissing his own life as inconsequential to the fate of the Islamic Republic. In fact, some Iran experts said he expected to be martyred. "But during wartime," said one of the people interviewed, "he did take some precautions. It was unusual for him not to be in his bunker. He had two bunkers. And if he had been, Israel wouldn't have been able to reach him with bombs that they have," the person said. Even in June 2025, in the throes of full-blown war, Israel made no known attempts to bomb Khamenei. It had instead targeted mostly the leadership of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, missile launchers and stockpiles, and Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists. While President Trump had repeatedly threatened to attack Iran in recent weeks, building up an armada off its shores, negotiations between the U.S. and Iran over the Islamic Republic's nuclear program were meant to continue last week. Oman, the mediator, said Iran was willing to make concessions that might help stave off a war and described the meeting on February 26 as fruitful. In public, the U.S. president grumbled that things were moving too slowly, but a person familiar with the matter said that, in private, Trump was dissatisfied with the Iranian responses, paving the way for war. A person briefed on the situation said the attack on Iran had been planned for months, but officials adjusted their operation after the U.S. and Israeli intelligence confirmed that Khamenei and his senior officials would be meeting in his compound in Tehran on Saturday morning. Tracking individual targets used to be laborious work, requiring visual confirmations and parsing false confirmations, but Israel's vast algorithm-driven data collection had automated that task in recent years. But for a target as high-value as Khamenei, failure was not an option. Israeli military doctrine requires that two separate senior officers, working independently from each other, confirm with high certainty that a target is in the location that is to be attacked and whom he is accompanied by. In this instance, according to two people familiar with the matter, Israeli intelligence had information from signals intelligence, such as the hacked traffic cameras and deeply penetrated mobile phone networks. One of the people said it showed that the meeting with Khamenei was on schedule, with senior officials heading to the location. But the Americans had something even more concrete, a human source, Both people familiar with the situation said the CIA declined to comment. At 3:38 p.m. Eastern Time on Friday, February 27th, Trump, traveling on Air Force One to Texas, gave the order to proceed with Operation Epic Fury, the U.S.-led strikes on Iran. The U.S. military cleared the path for Israeli fighter jets to bomb Khamenei's compound by launching cyber attacks, disrupting, degrading, and blinding Iran's ability to see, communicate, and respond, according to General Dan Kane, chair of the U.S. Joint Chiefs of Staff. Kane said the strike on the compound took place in daylight because, based on a trigger event, the Israel Defense Forces were able to carry out with the help from U.S. intelligence. The Israeli jets, which had been flying for hours in order to arrive on time at the right location, fired off as many as 30 precision munitions on Khamenei's complex, a former senior Israeli intelligence official said. The Israeli military said that striking in daylight provided an advantage. The decision to strike in the morning rather than at night allowed Israel to achieve tactical surprise for the second time, despite heavy Iranian preparedness, it said. The tactical success was the culmination of two separate events, more than 20 years apart, said Seema Shine, a former official at Mossad who had a focus on Iran. The first was a directive given in 2001 from former Prime Minister Ariel Sharon to Meir Dagan, the then head of Mossad, which was preoccupied with Syria, Palestinian militants, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and others to make Iran a priority. All the things the Mossad is doing is well and fine, Sharon told Dagan, according to Shine. What I need is Iran. That's your target. And since then, that is the target, she said. Israel has sabotaged Iran's nuclear program, killed its scientists, fought back its proxies, and even destroyed the military infrastructure of its crucial ally Syria in the days after dictator Bashar al-Assad was ousted. But Iranian intelligence agencies were formidable adversaries. In 2022, a group tied to Iranian security services released data purportedly siphoned from a phone belonging to the Mossad chief's wife. Iran also hacked CCTV cameras in Jerusalem during the 2025 war to get real-time damage assessments that the Israelis had censored from broadcast. It bought photographs of missile defenses and even mapped the jogging route of a major politician by bribing Israeli citizens, according to Israeli prosecutors. The second event, Shine added, was the October 7th, 2023 cross-border attack from Hamas, which Israel claims was backed by Iran and changed a long-standing calculus in Israel, that despite having penetrated the circles of several enemy heads of state, from Egypt's Gamal Abdel Nasser to Syria's Hafez al-Assad, their killings were off-limits even at times of war. Killing foreign leaders is not just taboo, but operationally fraught. Failure only adds to their stature, as it did following the CIA's many botched attempts to kill Cuba's Fidel Castro, while success can set into motion unpredictable chaos. But, said Shine, Israel's string of intelligence coups, including the 2024 assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran, and a $300 million multi-year clandestine project to booby-trap thousands of Hezbollah pagers and radios, has its own seductive powers. In Hebrew, we say, with the food comes the appetite, she said. In other words, the more you have, the more you want. This was originally published in the Financial Times. Thank you. Here's an obituary for a man some of you may remember from an earlier wartime. The counterculture icon who rallied Woodstock. Country Joe McDonald, 1942 to 2026. Through his darkly funny folk songs, Country Joe McDonald narrated the struggles of a generation radicalized by the Vietnam War. He was best known for his Vietnam War protest anthem, "I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die, Rag," 1965. But it was the cheer he led just before that at Woodstock that rallied the audience to the cause. He and his psychedelic folk rock group, Country Joe and the Fish, used to open shows with a chant of F-I-S-H and had the crowd shout along. By the time they got to Woodstock, they replaced that with a more vulgar four-letter word. From the moment I yelled, "Give us an F," it became a folk protest moment, said McDonald in 2002. There was a certain in-your-face Kurt Cobain-ness about it that matched the attitude of the time pretty well. Raised in El Monte, California, by Communist Party members who named him for Joseph Stalin, Joseph Allen McDonald was born to be a leftist and an activist, said the Washington Post. After a stint in the Navy, he attended college in Los Angeles and planned to transfer to UC Berkeley, but ended up busking on the streets there instead. He became a major presence in the Bay Area music scene, dating Janis Joplin, putting out the arts and politics magazine Rag Baby, and writing psychedelic folk songs. His seminal "I Feel Like I'm Fixin' to Die, Rag" was completed in less than an hour, said The Guardian. The deadpan talking track was a mock celebration of war and early senseless death from the jaded viewpoint of a draftee. "And it's 1, 2, 3, what are we fighting for? Don't ask me, I don't give a damn. Next stop is Vietnam." The song established him as a countercultural icon. McDonald never achieved the mainstream success of peers like the Grateful Dead or Jefferson Airplane, but he remained true to his musical instincts and lyrical themes, said the New York Times. One album explored feminism, another environmentalism. In his 1986 album, Vietnam Experience, look back at the effects and legacy of the war. His final studio album, 2017's 50, celebrated his own half-century as a singer-songwriter and political rebel. "I think the Summer of Love thing was manufactured by media or something, because I don't remember us thinking, 'Wow, this is the Summer of Love,'" he said in 2018. "I never felt part of it, but I was really thrilled and happy to be a hippie." Here's one of the health and science short pieces. Why backyard birds are dying off. The ongoing decline in U.S. bird populations is accelerating faster every year, a large new study shows. The depressing finding confirms what ornithologists have long feared, reports the Washington Post. Researchers analyzed decades of data from the North American Breeding Bird Survey, in which thousands of scientists and other amateur birders fan out each June along some 4,100 routes across the continent to count every bird they can find. They found that surveyors are now spotting roughly 300 fewer birds per route than they did in the late 1980s, a 15% drop. And it isn't obscure or already endangered birds bearing the brunt of the declines. It's familiar backyard species such as blackbirds and robins. Alarmingly, the biggest drops are being seen in regions with heavy pesticide and fertilizer use, which suggests a link to farming. That's a problem, not just for biodiversity, but also for humans, since birds are often affected first by conditions that plague humans. The pesticide DDT, for example, was seen to harm bald eagle eggs and then later shown to disrupt human hormones. Amanda Rodewald of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, who wasn't involved in the study, says the findings should be a wake-up call about the dangers contaminants pose to all creatures. We live in the same environment as birds. And if they're not healthy for them, they're unlikely to be healthy for us. And finishing out on the talking points page as we usually do, let's see, we'll do Tallarico, Democrats' Great Texas Hope. James Tallarico just put Texas in play for November, said Philip Elliott in Time. A state representative and Presbyterian seminarian, he trounced U.S. Representative Jasmine Crockett by 6 percentage points last week to win the state's Democratic Senate primary. His win was the result of an inclusive, economically populist campaign that put his faith front and center. Tallarico, 36, showed up in GOP strongholds long ignored by Democrats and, during swing through West Texas, dropped off the trail to preach at Lubbock's Covenant Presbyterian, where the faithful hung on every word of his 10-minute sermon. His relentlessly hopeful style energized the electorate. More than 2.3 million people voted in the Democratic primary, the most since 2000, and the first time since 2008 that Democratic participation exceeded GOP turnout. Crucially, Tallarico dominated his race in heavily Latino areas, said Zishan Alim in MS.Now. It's a sign Democrats can win back a demographic that had been trending Republican, cause for the party to be optimistic in Texas and elsewhere in the midterms. Tallarico climbed a big hill, said Ronald Brownstein in CNN.com. But now he faces a mountain. No Democrat has won a statewide race in the Lone Star State since 1994. Party infrastructure across Texas remains skeletal, and other Texas Democrats have inspired Tallarico-like excitement. Stand up, Beto O'Rourke, only to falter. Then there's the still undecided question of which Republican he'll face in November. Scandal-plagued State Attorney General Ken Paxton, or the stronger incumbent, Senator John Cornyn. And Tallarico's hipster Christianity ain't going to sell statewide, said Jeffrey Blehar in National Review. This is a man who has preached God is non-binary, ranted against Christian schools, and used the Annunciation to justify abortion. That trendy twaddle will raise gigantic red flags for every serious Christian. As a conservative Christian, I disagree with Tallarico on many matters of theology and ideology, said David French in the New York Times. But it's inspiring to be reminded that Christian politicians can actually act like Christians. Tallarico campaigned with genuine compassion, declaring in his primary night speech that he was tired of being told to hate my neighbor. Compare that with the MAGA Christianity, where cruelty in the name of Trumpism is no vice, and kindness in the name of progressivism is no virtue. Tallarico may not win the Senate seat in November, but he has shown that kindness still has a place in the public square. And we'll run through a few of the short notes. A year after the Elon Musk-led Doge purged hundreds of thousands of federal employees, the Trump administration has ramped up hiring. We probably have some skills that we now need to hire back, quite frankly, said Scott Kupor, head of the Office of Personnel Management. Some agencies are struggling to fill vacancies. At Veterans Affairs, job applications are down 50% year on year. Emergency room orders for acetaminophen, or Tylenol, for pregnant patients dropped 10% after President Trump claimed without evidence last September that the drug raises the risk of autism among unborn children. Meanwhile, outpatient prescriptions for leucovorin, a B vitamin for 8 to 17-year-olds, rose 71% after Trump promoted the drug as an autism treatment. In a survey of 25 countries, the U.S. was the only nation where the majority of respondents described the morality and ethics of their fellow citizens as bad. 53% of Americans polled by Pew Research Center rated their compatriots as somewhat bad or very bad. Only 7% of Canadians said the same. On the Poll Watch, 67% of Americans have confidence in career scientists at federal health agencies, compared with 43% who have confidence in agency leaders brought in by Health Secretary Robert F. Kennedy Jr. 38% have confidence in Kennedy. 77% have confidence in the American Academy of Pediatrics. And we'll get two quick quotes. Soren Kierkegaard says, "Life can only be understood backward, but it must be lived forward." And Isaac Asimov says, "Violence is the last refuge of incompetence." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. The Week magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.